One afternoon, I picked up a book of poems by Henry Longfellow, the American poet, and I read a small poem in which made me think about writing reminiscences of my youth. The poem was short and started with the words, "Often I think of that beautiful town that is seated by the sea, and often in thought go up and down the pleasant streets of that dear old town, and my youth comes back to me." That poem set me thinking, and so, with plenty of time to spare in my retirement days, I decided to put down on paper thoughts of my earliest days in this village. I can remember starting school at the infants. There were two lady teachers there, Miss Sansbury and Miss Castain. We learned the alphabet and sang some nursery rhymes in the lower classes, and in the higher classes we were taught to count, do sums, and taught to sing little songs which she wrote on the blackboard. The 1914-18 war was on, and often we were let out of school sometimes to see the aeroplanes, and one morning we saw a ship coming towards the pier and being held on a rock just outside. It was there for a few days, I remember, and one evening I went down to the pier with my mother to see it. It was refloated and towed away shortly afterwards. It was called the Lady Plymouth. A ship had been torpedoed by submarines, and a lot of survivors were landed in the village one day. They were here for a day or so, and then they went to England. Small naval boats would be often at the pier in those early days, and we lads would be going down to see them of an evening. There were war bulletins posted up in the local post office window, but they were always too high for we boys to read. I remembered one of them, the last, which was in large letters and lower down, stating the fact that peace was declared. That was the first Armistice Day, 1918. It sounded as the war was just starting again in the village, and all kinds of fireworks were let off in the high street from morning till night. We lads knew there was a war on, but we didn't really pay much attention to it as we were very young. There were no soldiers billeted in the village, but there was a voluntary force of local men who used to do guard duty at Douglas. Occasionally there would be a soldier or sailor home on leave who would talk to us about adventures in the forces. One of the local schooners, the Bessie, was destroyed by a submarine, but the crew of three men escaped in a small boat and managed to get into one of the ports of the island. Occasionally, gunfire would be heard of an evening, which alerted the village for a while. When we boys were 7 years of age, we were taken to the boys' school. There we were placed in Standard 1. Miss Gell was the teacher. There we were taught history, writing, arithmetic, and reading aloud. Mr. Place was the headmaster, but he retired early as he was ill, and he was replaced by Mr. Wilkinson. Mr. Corlett was the other master. Miss Gell taught Standard 1 and 2, Mr. Corlett taught 3 and 4, and Mr. Wilkinson taught 5 and 6. As it was wartime, there were many ships sunk in the Irish Sea, and bodies of seamen would be washed up in the small beaches around the island, where youngsters would watch while men would carry bodies up from the rocks and place them on a small ambulance and take them to one of the buildings which was always used for the purpose. A coal boat went ashore on Gansey Rocks, I remember. I forget the name of the ship. It had a cream-painted funnel. It had to be emptied of its cargo by men who would shovel it over the side into the stiff carts, which were pulled up to the grass by the horses. We boys, too, went to see the ships every evening, as men and tugboats were preparing to float the ship off the rocks. It was floated off whilst we were at school. Gansey Rocks had been the scene of many shipwrecks. Small boats tied up at the harbour would be found smashed on the Gansey Rocks of a stormy night, and a few schooners in later years have been blown onto the rocks, but they were successfully towed off again. After school and on Saturdays, we went to the rocks to fish bulkies, what some older men called bulkions. Occasionally we caught ballons, which we brought home to cook for the cat. We used to have iron hoops as well, and crooks, which we rolled along the streets and sometimes to Calby and back. The hoops were made at the smithy down below at Port Bourke. Mr. Hashi Castain was the name of the smith, and when the hoop broke, we went back to him to have it spliced. An old retired captain, Mr. John Crow, bought me my first hoop. As time went on, motor traffic appeared on the roads, and the police stopped us playing with our hoops. In the spring in the 1920s, the herring boats, which were reared up on the top of the harbour, were refloated and were moved and moored at the new quay, when the men painted and patched and had the nets taken aboard. They had been stored in the Qualtro's warehouse for the winter months. On the bows and the sails, the registered numbers of the Nickies were painted. The port of registry was Castletown those days, so the initial CT and the registered numbers were painted on in bold letters. None of the herring boats went to Kinsale those days, as there were no young men on the boats to assist. Occasionally, some boys would join the crews and go out with them to the fishing grounds of an evening. The men relied on the sails those days. Engines were installed later on in the 1930s. Mr. Ambrose Madrill, a famous poet who lived up the How, wrote some beautiful poems about the fishing boats. In a poem he wrote that, "We like to remember those old whiskered men who, cradled in fishing, carried on to the end." I can recall some of the names of those old men. There was Harry Castain from the Four Roads, Willie Hudson from Serby, Mr. Ronan from the How, Willie Cool, better known as Itty, from the Largan, Thomas Samuel Kelly, also from the Largan, Willie Corris from the Underway, Mr. John Watterson and Mr. Nelson from Glenchash, Ned and Jack Keggin, brothers from Fistard, Harry Moore the Moo from the Largan was another, and Mr. Harry Cregeen from the High Street, skipper of the Expert, CT-55, who had the only Englishman with him, Mr. Joe Payton. Later on, Mr. Willie Ratliff had the Lily, CT-4. He was the last of the old-time fishermen. Here I will pause for a poem about some old men I knew in a little cottage that I've called the Largan Cottage. Down in the south, in Portrait Mary, I was visiting some friends. I am often there, for it is my hometown. Passing up the Largan Road, I was surprised at what I saw. That old cottage there of Cool's had been pulled down. Thoughts of other days came to me, for I knew that cottage well. No one's lived in it for years, they'd all passed on. I'd spent many pleasant evenings in that kitchen with the men. All that generation now are dead and gone. Back in Douglas I kept thinking of the old times in the port, how that cottage used to be a meeting place, who the people were who lived there, how they had it neat and clean. Now there's nothing left to show, no stone, no trace. Situated up the Largan, number one screwed on the door, there lived Seeky and his brother, Willie Cool. They'd another brother, Jack, too. I could just remember him. He passed on about the time I started school. Times I've watched them thatch the cottage. Later on they had it tiled. Walls would dazzle with the whitewash laid on thick. An uncommon block of greenstone made the very high door step, patterned, as was custom, with the white chalk brick. Inside everything was cosy, clean and beautifully kept. They were sailors, so of course had housewives' hands. On the dresser, lovely crockery of generations old, plates and china hens and jugs with golden bands. Seeky'd been a schooner sailor, on the Gold Seeker was mate. When the days of sail declined, he stayed ashore, worked in later life as coal man, used to drive a horse and cart, bringing coal to houses from a local store. Small in stature, short in temper, Seeky could be sometimes rude, quite a crabby chap from some folks' point of view. Strictly total, no bad language, and a Methodist by faith, every Sunday there was Seeky in his pew. As regards his brother Willie, he was quite a different man, fond of beer and swearing when he'd had too much. Not for him the straight and narrow, with the bay view close at hand, as for chapel, was completely out of touch. He'd be full of the regatta, beating time out to the band, then again, when Russian team brought home a cup. Being dark, he'd be invited to be quellfuck in some homes. He could always find a good excuse to stop. Seeky used to hold the purse strings. Willie always was the cook. Every Sunday there was broth and rice and duff. Willie'd have the pot on early, supping broth by basinfuls, pouring water in, that Seeky'd have enough. In that homely little cottage, men would gather for a yarn. Often crowded it would be, or just the few, puffing black and old clay cutties, spitting neatly in the fire. The tobacco was that strong, the air was blue. Old Ned Convery from two doors up would be sitting by the fire, with the old cat digging claws in on his knee. John James Clucas, Dickie Qualtro, Arthur Miller, Harry Known, my grandfather Joseph Crellin sat by me. Tommy Kane would be in sometimes, Francis Corrish, Tom Crigeen, Thomas Samuel Kelly and Paul Kelly too, Bill McGinn and Jimmy Clugston, Eddie Kegan, Teddy Swales, Ambrose Collister and Harry Moore the Moo. Talk would range from foreign countries to the price of coal at home, tales of schooners disappearing on the seas, lifeboat rescues, herring fishing, making chicken rock relief, who the right man was to put into the keys. What a pleasure it was listening to the old Manx dialect, spoken naturally, easy, slow and plain. Happy times I'd spent with those men, they were pleasant company. There will never be their kind on earth again. That old cottage had to go because the road was narrow there. Generations have their day and must go too. Going are the old Manx customs, the old thousands and folklore. There will never be the times that once we knew. Quadro's yard was situated down at the New Quay. They were boat builders. The warehouse there is all that is left of a very busy shipbuilding yard. There was always something interesting going on at the yard. Nicky's would be on the beach at the side of the New Quay at Port Vurk, that's what the little beach was called. A schooner was sitting on great wooden blocks one time. That schooner was there a long time on the beach. How nice it was to go down to the quay and get the smell of Stockholm tar and sawdust. Well, we lads were growing up fast, and so on a Saturday we would be playing football either on the Cronk or at the Chapel Beach. All the boys in the south would be playing football in those days, and there would be teams from the How and Fisted playing against us sometimes, and fighting was common. In the summertime, our herring boats would be joined by an invasion of Scotch steam drifters. I have counted 100 of them there at the pier one morning. The Scottish fishermen were a decent lot of men. We lads would be down there of a morning, and we could take as many whiting as we liked to sell up in the village. We would get a drink of tea sometimes when we made friends of the cooks. There was a lot of local men with ponies and carts who would come to buy herrings to sell. They were called the Cadgers. They would be Arthur Watt from Port Erin, a blind man, Mr. Duggan, whose wife sat with him in the cart, Mr. Christian from Calby, and Mr. Harry Freestone from Castletown, who had two donkeys in the shafts. Carrots would be offered to the donkeys by the children of the port as the cart went up the road. The common price for the herring was shouted out as the cadgers went up through the village, usually 16 for a shilling. The Manx people in those days got their stock in for the winter, and the cadgers would be all day counting out thousands of herring to most of the houses. It was a busy time for the housewives too, who had to rile the herrings, that was to put salt on them and stir them in a large tin bath, then put them into earthenware jar called a crock. The herrings would be put into the crock after the gills and the silver swim would be removed and packed with the back of the herrings underneath, then the next row would be packed at right angles to the previous row. Then a strong solution of salt and water would have to be made to cover the herring to keep out the air. The brine had to be so that a potato would float on it. In the winter nights, the herrings would be grilled in front of the fire in many homes. After being laid in water for 2 nights to take some of the salt out, the Scottish girls came to the village too to clean the herrings for some of the large firms who came to export the herrings to the continent. Sometimes they would be working long hours, and visitors would stand and watch them and take photographs of them. On Sunday, the girls would parade up and down the pier knitting. Occasionally, we lads would hear 2 rockets fired from the lifeboat house, which signalled that some boat was in distress and the lifeboat was to be launched to render assistance. We village lads would always be there. It was an exciting time for us. In those days, the lifeboat was kept in a boathouse and had to be launched by a lot of helpers using block and tackle. Whilst the crew were getting their oilskins and lifebelts on, we lads would be in the thick of it, paying out the launching ropes while the older men eased the carriage and boat down the slipway. Someone would blow a whistle when we held onto the ropes tightly whilst the crew got on board and were handed the oars. The sail was got ready also, as it might be used once the lifeboat got out clear of the pier. The whistle would blow again, and the carriage would be moved towards the tide. Then suddenly, the carriage would be pushed as hard as possible for a few yards, and then held tight by the ropes as the lifeboat slid off the carriage and floated. The carriage was then towed halfway up the slipway and taken apart in two sections, greased and oiled, and then awaited the return of the lifeboat. It was a hard job to rehouse the lifeboat, as some of the men who were at the launching had to go to work. Some of we lads, as we got older, would get a badge to use whilst the boat was being launched. When the lifeboat was installed and the doors closed again, we would hand in our badges and a man would take our names. Later on in the week, we would meet the harbour master, who would pay out us our wages for the launch, 3 shillings. Lifeboat day, held in the summer, was another busy day for we lads. We would be up at the late Mrs. Kelly's house, Rocklands, to get a tray of flowers and some lifeboat flags to sell on the street to the visitors who would be there. Afterwards, we would run down the road to the lifeboat house in order to help pull the lifeboat out of the house and pull it up the village and over the promenade and back. Usually some visitors would dress up with oilskins and lifebelts and get into the lifeboat and call for money from the visitors as they rattled their buckets. In the afternoon, the lifeboat was launched to take visitors around the bay. Sometimes there was a dance held in the town hall at night. Sometimes a schooner would be blown onto Guernsey Rocks on stormy days, and another schooner was wrecked further along the beach in the same week one time. We lads missed those two launches as we were in school. And another time too comes to my mind. I think it would be in 1922 when the lifeboat rockets went off again. And going down the street in the next morning, as Sunday, I was told by someone that a steamer had gone on the rocks at the sound. In the afternoon, a few of we lads decided to walk to the sound to see it. The fog was very dense at the time, so we didn't see any sign of the ship. We were told that it was on the rocks at the Thusler Rock. The ship was a wreck, and the cargo was taken off and landed at Port St. Mary Harbour. Several bales of cotton were found in the beaches later on and were used by some of the locals to make mats. As time went on, stories were told of sewing machines and crates of whiskey which found their way into quite a few homes in the village and roundabout. Playing cards too and pewter mugs were often seen in some houses. The steamer that was wrecked was one of the clan line called the Clan MacMaster. All our youthful days would be spent around the harbour. We were growing up and were fishing out at the end of the pier. Port St. Mary is a tidal harbour, and when the tide was out, we would be down there digging up lugworms with garden forks. By some of the rocks we would find rockworms, and further up the beach near the high water mark we would dig up some thin red worms, which were called by the old fishermen a Manx name of jugans. In the summer we would go to the kipper house and get melt for bait. The old retired sailors were very good to we lads. They would take us out in small rowing boats to teach us how to row. Sometimes we would go out in sailing boats on quiet days. Most of us could row with 2 hours by the time we were 8 years of age. When we returned after a day's fishing in later days, we would always share our catch with these old men. There were no dull moments for we lads in those far-off days. Some men hired fleets of rowing boats in the summer. There was Francis Corris, John Moore, and Norman Keggin. Francis and John hired their boats from the slipway below the Golflings Hotel, while Norman hired his boat from the Chapel Beach. We boys would always be about and row the old ladies around the bay for a shilling an hour. The boats were laid up in a yard for the winter. We were active in the winter time too. On Monday evenings, we would attend the Band of Hope meeting. The girls would sit on the left and the boys on the right in the old Wesleyan Sunday School, now demolished, down the High Street. The girls would sing and recite more items than the boys did. Sometimes a few boys would be persuaded to get up and sing songs which they learned at school. Some Monday nights there would be talks. At other times, magic lantern shows. Then Hoptunay came around in November, when one would hear various versions of an old Manx rhyme that was sung. There was no proper tune to it, so I think it died. It's died out nowadays. It was sung in every village years ago, but in the villages, all the words were different. One day, I think it was November, a terrible tragedy occurred one Saturday. 2 boys were in a garden at Fishton playing. As they passed a garden shed, one of the boys noticed a shotgun lying on the bench. He dashed in and took it up and pointed it at the other boy, and then he pulled the trigger and accidentally shot him. We boys at school the following week were given a series of lectures never to handle guns. Most of us had never seen a gun, as we were only schoolboys those days. The funeral of that poor boy was held later on, and any boy could attend. Quite a lot of boys walked to Fishton that afternoon, and we were marshalled in twos to walk in front of the horse hearse. Slowly we walked through the village. When passing the school, we saw that the boys who didn't attend the funeral were formed up on either side of the road as we passed, and a lot of elderly people were with them. When we passed the girls too were paraded on either side. That would be in 1920, I think. We lads could all row boats by the 1920s. On fine days, we were allowed to go out a mile or so beyond the pier to fish, but we had to return when the rocks were covered by the sea. The old fishermen told us where to go and when to return because of the nature of the tide. We were told by the old men how the tide changed during the days. We learned that 2 hours before the tide would be at its lowest, that it would start flowing back into the bay. Then 2 hours before the tide was at high water, the tide would start to ebb out. The strongest tides were at new moon and full moon, when we lads should not go out. Later on, maybe after another 2 years had passed, we would venture out to the Sugarloaf and sometimes go to Spanish Head when there was a chance to get some codfish. We wrote down all the fishing marks that we knew, and I still have them here with me today. The sea can be very treacherous though, and one has to be on the alert all the time when afloat. I had a lucky escape from drowning one fine evening. Coming in after fishing with two young lads with me, I rode into the Brewery Bay to land the boys who had to walk to Calbi. There was no wind, and the sea was quite calm, and the tide was going out. I then turned the boat and headed back for the harbour, when after a few minutes I suddenly received a heavy blow as though another boat had hit me. I stopped rowing and saw a tidal wave pass me on its way to the head, to the beach. I received a bit of a fright as I watched the tidal wave expend itself on the beach. It went a long way up. It was about 2 feet high or so or more when it passed me. I looked around then to see whether there any more waves coming. Then I resumed rowing for the harbour. There was no one on the beach at that time, and there was no other boat around either. When I got in, I never mentioned to anyone what had befallen me. That is the end of part one of my narrative.